Welcome to another edition of Dugout Study Hall, a remedial course in baseball stats and proud member of the Pitcher List Podcast Network. I'm your host and expert layman, Matt Goodwin, and I am joined, as always, by my co-host and your fake baseball economist, Alexander Chase. On this episode, we will talk about September call-ups, the new system for expanding rosters, including the good, the bad, and the ugly, and how to make sense of what makes sense. But before we get to all of that, Alexander, how you doing?
You know, I am not doing too bad, Matt. How about yourself?
I'm going to be honest. I'm a little anxious. We are actually recording this on Saturday, which we never do. We record Tuesdays, Wednesdays. Every now and then we do a Monday. But I am in the line of fire of a giant hurricane, which is coming overnight tonight. And we don't want to let the audience down by not having an episode for this week. And so we carved out some space tonight. I spent a lot of the day securing loose furniture, moving a giant mulch pile that I had been lazy about so that I could put my car into the garage so that if a tree falls, the garage will take it, not my tree. I mean, not my car, not my tree. It'll probably be my tree. That's not great. But I don't know. We'll see. The track of the storm keeps changing. Initially, earlier today, it was like doomsday. But where it's going to make landfall... maybe is a little better for us, but worse for somebody else. So I'm not happy about that for them. But anyway, that's where my brain's at. All over the place, scattered, chaotic, a little nervous, a little anxious. But at least it gives us something to legitimately talk about that fulfills our talk about the weather quota. So that's good. We got that out of the way.
And it is crazy to us, or crazy to me, that that's like always on the agenda. We can't avoid that, can we?
No, it's so cliche. We got to lean into it, I think. Just lean into it, and it just becomes that silly thing that we do. It's unintentional shtick that has become intentional shtick, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. I mean, everyone needs some good shtick.
Well, let's keep up the weather theme because I think it's going to be relevant to the bell ringer question I have for you today. And that's, what are your thoughts and your feelings about fall, the season in general?
I'm a fan of fall. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I have to rank the seasons, I'm not all that well equipped to do it because they don't exist in Texas. So I didn't grow up with seasons. But we have ideas of seasons that rotate around week to week, and I'm sure you've seen a poorly JPEG'd Facebook post at some point about something like this for your region, wherever you are, whoever you are. But, you know, there's a week of spring that's really nice in Texas where it's, like, not that humid in the mornings, and there's dew on the ground, and it's nice and crisp. Wake up, it's around 50, daytime highs in the upper 70s, and that's beautiful.
Yeah.
I never really understood the East Coast version of fall, also where like the leaves change color, because the leaves don't change color in Texas. Right. They're generally just mesquite tree bristles that attack you, and then there's thorns underneath them. So yeah,
sounds awful.
Yeah. But being able to see actual leaves actually changing, really cool. Big fan of that.
Yeah. No, I really do love fall. I will say that fall means the end of my summer vacation. Which once again, to people who don't have that, are probably not in line to cry, or shed a tear for me. But, that's the only downside. I actually do love it. I love the air gets a little crisp. I'm a little further north than you are. So I really kind of get that old New England autumn cliche in the movies kind of thing with the leaves changing and the weather and right up till about Halloween and, into the beginning of November. It's a really beautiful time of year around here. So I actually really do enjoy it. I like when you can leave the windows open at night instead of having to have the air conditioner on because it's too humid or uncomfortable. So now I like fall a lot. I might even rank it number one if I didn't have most of my summer off. I think that by default wins in the ranking of the seasons. But fall, I think, is probably maybe the most enjoyable for me. So I'm looking forward to it in that regard. And one of the things that comes with fall in baseball, which is what we're supposed to be talking about here, is the call-ups, the rosters expand, right? So that's kind of what we're going to talk about today. I'll transition right here into the number of the week because I think this is an important distinction and we should talk about it right off the bat. And the number is 2, and that's the number of additional roster spots MLB teams will have now. And that's different. And it's certainly different from last year when we had the COVID situation. It's very different from the way it was done pre-COVID. So the last time it was the old way would have been 2019. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about what that new system is, how it compares to the old system. Before we kind of get into what matters and doesn't matter, let's understand the context of that.
So I'm going to put on and then immediately take off the tinfoil for my head. So just bear with me. So I tend to believe that the way MLB rules set up make the entire system of like how we talk about prospects way more confusing than it has to be. And here's a tinfoil bit as part of a bit to try to make it more confusing for people to understand how messed up a lot of it is. It's very vague as to like how people get shuffled around for a lot of people, I tend to think. And that's not great. The way that the system works as of right now is, you know, you're in the minors. And at some point, if you're like within shouting distance, essentially, of being on a Major League Baseball field, you get added to the 40-man roster. And when you're on the 40-man roster, those are the people who are protected from the Rule 5 draft, just to kind of call back to something else. You know, it's only people who have been like not on that for a while that are exposed. So Akil Baddoo was never on the 40-man for the Minnesota Twins before the Tigers drafted him. If you're on that roster, you know, that's the people who are being moved up and down, you know, being optioned. And if you're not on that list, you're not part of like this discussion. But the previous rules were that 25 of your 40-man roster people were
roster people.
Players. Is that a word? Do I want to they are people, they are players, they're both.
They are both.
Active, yes. During the year, pre-COVID, right?
Right.
Yes. And then there was going to be, I think, some change, as you said, and then this is the first year where like all of like the things have been changed and it's been instituted. So it used to be 25 people and then 40 in September, and now it's 26 for most of the year and then 28 in September. That extra full-time roster spot is a big deal, because that is another person who is drawing an MLB salary, which is good.
Right.
Yep. But the downside is then there are some people who like don't get the opportunity to be on a roster and drawing some extra money in September. And also there's some implications about like clock starting. That's not really like the discussion for right now, but yeah, generally speaking though, the upshot of this for what we have to care about and how that affects things writ large is that there just aren't going to be as many people who debut.
Right.
Now, that's not going to matter nearly as much for kind of like near-term, short-term fantasy. We'll talk about some guys who I think probably would have still come up during September under the new system, but back in the old days, if that makes sense. But you'll definitely see far fewer guys who are like sixth, seventh starters who get a shot and like outperform expectations and get a longer look, or relievers who have a really hot month and then get some more leverage opportunities and get a career out of that. You know, those sorts of guys.
Yeah, yeah. Well, they used to have so many spots that most teams wouldn't even call that many up. I don't know of any teams that were actually carrying 40 people in their dugouts and their bullpens, right? It's an insane number. So there was plenty of room to pull up whoever you wanted to take a look at or whoever you thought might benefit from an appearance. And it's different now. So that certainly is going to keep some people in the minors and out of making their debuts making their debut is a little bit technically it is, but it is a different situation, different time of year, whether their team's in it or not does make a difference. But anyway, I digress at that.
Is worth probably bringing up here is like the levers teams can pull to make some more 40-man space, by the way, just kind of like as a you might see some other moves, and I think it's worth kind of contextualizing them here. If you are like DFA'd, this is like a pretty important season for guys being designated for assignment, because that'll get them off the 40-man roster, which will mean that you can call someone else up. If you, for example, you have a guy in AA, wasn't on your 40-man, but you want to give him a debut, seeing someone designated for assignment or move to the 60-day IL will clear that 40-man roster spot. So people who are being moved to the 60-day IL, like Jacob DeGrom, important for that reason. And there probably also is going to be some guys who are like just depth veterans who might get DFA'd so that you can get depth young guys instead. So
let me ask you this question. I don't know if you know the answer, so I apologize if I'm putting you on the spot and you don't know. When somebody gets called up, does that exercise an option when the rosters expand, or is that like, so if they call them up and send them back down, they're not optioning them back down?
I feel like I once knew this rule in much more detail when I was playing Out of the Park more, and it led me to actually look up the real rules and make sure they were right, though they're generally pretty good. Being called up, as I understand it, doesn't exercise any of your options. It's being sent back down. And it's, I think it has some sort of thing to do with like number of times a year. I should be more up to date on this.
No, that's okay. Listen, I put you on the spot, and we can certainly look into it and come back with real information. We certainly don't want to put out misinformation. I guess my question was, if somebody is called up and then sent back down during a roster expansion, is part of the rosters expanding an exception to having to exhaust an option? And if you don't know, that's totally fair. That's fine. I put you on the spot, and we'll look into that, and we'll come back to it on a future episode to make sure we have good information. So let's talk a little bit about what we need to know. So we understand the system now. We understand that it's different. We are going to see less of those minor leaguers making debuts just by the nature of the rule change. But we are probably still going to see the same number of impact call-ups that we would have. So in other words, in the old system, they had a lot of guys, but there were a lot of guys that didn't really make much of a difference, certainly for a fantasy team. And those that do would probably still be called up. You're talking about maybe five league-wide, right? So they're going to fit into that one or two spots that team has. So what do we need to know about September call-ups? That's kind of our question for today. What do we need to know? What stats do we look at? How do we evaluate this? Should we run to the wire and grab this person because they're going to be the one that helps us win in our playoffs? How do we know? Do we know? How do we take action, I guess, in the next few weeks here?
And I want to like couch my, hour, not quite hour, my next half hour long response to that question with a whole lot of shrugging and a whole lot of I care more about next year for these guys anyway. Now I do think that there are going to be actual like this year things that we can care about, and we will try to at least talk about those, but it's worth recognizing that when we look back on some of the past years, it is just chaos as to how many of the people who we think should be good are good. And how many of the people who we aren't all that sure about who end up having a pretty good show of themselves. So
I guess there's two ways to think about it, right? There's like the baseball side, which is I'm excited to see this guy. Maybe I think about him for drafts in my next year's fantasy league. And then there's the team right now that's in a playoff hunt and they want that edge. You know, maybe they're squeaking in fourth place, or you know, their team has been good all year, so they're making the playoffs, but they're struggling right now, and they're worried they're going to get bounced in the first round. Is one of these guys going to make the difference? So I think it's totally fair to say, like, yeah, the real answer here is what is the September call-up going to tell us about next year and the future? But there is that real thing that somebody out there wants to know about right now. And I obviously it's going to be a lot harder to have conclusions about somebody who's just getting their first shot than being able to look back over the course of what admittedly is going to be a small sample size, and is a small sample size for all players from this point to the rest of the season is a small sample size. And really anything can happen for anybody in such a small sample size. But I want to make sure we talk about both those things. So from a baseball point of view, or a looking forward to next year point of view, but also like right now in the moment, I need to get one more impact player on my team. And I know that this minor leaguer is probably getting called up. Do I need to use my waiver claim priority? How much should I be putting on this guy if I'm in a FOB system, and why? Right.
Yeah. I think, it's interesting in like the things that like normally we care about because they tell us a lot of information really quickly. are useful here as they are anywhere else. And this kind of presents a nice opportunity to kind of refresh on a few of those things, to remember what it is that tells us the most the fastest and just use it. So that's always nice. It's not like it's different what matters for a guy who has not played Major League Baseball before,
yeah,
versus if we're trying to reevaluate if someone's changed.
Right. Yeah.
Now,
fair point.
I mean, it's slightly different, but like not all that different. And that's kind of like the long and short of a lot of this. So that's nice. It's also definitely really nice that because I think for a lot of people, a lot of the baseball that we're going to be able to watch isn't going to matter all that much. It's kind of a cruel way to say it. But like, I mean, for fantasy, like realistically, how many people are going to have their playoffs end? Like, I don't know, like 3 weeks. If you know, we're like 6-7 weeks out, playoffs should be starting essentially for most people at this point who play in well-designed leagues. I don't want anything to do with those last 2 weeks of baseball.
Weekly league, especially the last week. But I'll say, like, I have a couple home leagues and I'm not in the playoffs yet. This isn't even like the last week. So, this definitely is, and there's a lot of people who just play standard and it does go to the end. So, I would even argue that maybe in those, as much as I don't want to be a part of that because it's such a crapshoot at the very end, there are a lot of people who do, and these guys that get called up might be a little bit more stability if you can be the one who gets the right one.
Yeah, it's also worth kind of just like paying attention to which guys might come up and wreak havoc for someone else who has a regular job right now.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, that's worth talking about. So, you know, if those are the stakes of all of this, if we're paying attention to this because we know that it might change things a little, but we're not like convinced we're gonna like, I don't know, redefine the entire everything about whatever league you're playing in. If we just know that it's gonna have some like unpredictable knock-on effects, and the most important and fun thing is just kind of like evaluating what happens next year, this is a really fun assignment to take on.
Yeah. Yeah, so let's get into it. Let's start with like what stats might matter, and I put "might" in air quotes. I know that's a visual cue for people who are listening, so I'm sorry about that. But yeah, I am. I am a little sorry. It's not probably going to stop me from doing it again, but you do, when you're listening and somebody does something visual and then they talk about how it was visual, you do feel a little left out. So for that, I definitely am sorry. Everything that we're going to talk about here is, it might help you. It might be the most likely to help you. It's not guaranteed to be the panacea here in terms of like, you are going to use this to find the right guy and win your league. And you're going to send us an email and tell us, thank you. It's more like, of all of the things that are out there, this is where you're most likely to get a maybe answer, right? That's a lot of qualifying, but it's still worth talking about. So let's start with the stats that might help.
Sure. The answer to this is pretty much always, we're looking for the stuff that will most quickly tell us the information about the things that determine performance the most. In other words, you want a large sample for things like home runs and strikeouts. And the numbers I'm going to be pointing to, this is mostly for batters, I want to admit, but at least partially will help out with pitching as well.
Although I will jump in, and I'm sorry. I think most of this is focused on hitting. If you're expecting a September call-up pitcher to make a huge difference, yeah, that's probably fool's gold no matter what, because if they're great, it's going to be only a couple of starts maybe, and probably not like 6-inning starts if you're in a quality start league. So I think it's okay if we focus mostly on hitters, because I think that's definitely the most likely place for us to squeeze some value.
Yeah. I think that if we're talking about pitchers, that's exclusively going to be for the, I want to know about what this guy is all about for the future. And even like, good luck. We're looking for things like, if I can point to two numbers there, chase rate and zone contact rate. I like to focus in on chase rate, not because it's my Twitter handle, but because I think it's one of the more important stats that we can use to evaluate what a player is all about in context, usually. So the decisions that a player is making about when they're chasing and when they're not, and kind of like how well they're reading the zone are really important, because it is ultimately based on a decision, even if it's, you know, very much impacted by some sort of actual skill, right?
Right.
So if you're like committing to swinging a lot versus not committing to swinging a lot, there are a lot of interesting things you can glean from that. You know, wrap your head around the hypothetical swing at everything sort of guys. I think of Hans or Alberto every time. and then try to compare that to a guy who's, you know, like just got a bad read of the zone. Hans or Alberto is just doing that on purpose because he's making a lot of contact. His zone contact numbers are pretty high. It will allow him to chase a lot. It's a choice, right?
Yeah, right. He's making that that sacrifice, so to speak, right, for the benefit right. of what happens when he's swinging a lot. But then, yeah, there are people who are not who are swinging at bad pitches because they are not able to recognize it's a bad pitch, and that's a totally different thing. That's not like a skill and a choice.
Right. Right. Yeah. And I think the way that you look at that is sometimes a little bit complicated, but there are some pretty good tells. You know, if someone's not making a whole lot of contact on pitches in the zone, it means they're probably guessing wrong. Yeah. If someone's making a good amount of contact on pitches in the zone and then, you know, they also chase a bit, there's probably some bat to ball skill there and a decision about approach. And you can question that, and some people need to tweak those things, but sure. You know, if you notice that someone is doing a really good job of not chasing outside the zone all that often and isn't also like falling victim to a bunch of call strikes, you know, it seems like they've got like a pretty good differentiation between like chase rate and then like their zone swing rate. You know, if one of those is really good and one of those is pretty average, that's probably not a terrible thing. And those are the sorts of things, this is really important, they're going to stabilize even faster than strikeout rate will, because it's based on larger samples. And that's just kind of like a you don't even have to do the math yourself to get how like the laws of the math there work.
Well, yeah. I mean, if you think about the average at bat, let's say has four pitches, right? Mm-hmm. And a strikeout can something only like happen that. Once per at bat. You're talking about four times more data to work with in a shorter amount of time. It makes perfect sense. So I'm going to just clarify. So you're talking about using chase rate and zone contact in tandem to try and get a sense of things, or are you looking at them more independently and they're two good things to look at, and they're good to look at because they stabilize quickly?
Something closer to the second, probably.
Okay.
Yeah, it's somewhere in between. It's like there are multiple different things you can glean about approach and also, I guess, also about skill. You know, I like to look at zone contact as opposed to chase rate, just as kind of like as a marker of like what someone's good case bat to ball skills are. It allows you to differentiate between someone who's really good at putting the bat on the ball and someone who's not, and maybe is kind of like changing their approach as a result if they're up. You know, someone like Joey Gallo is swinging really hard, and that choice isn't going to mean that he's not like choking up as often, or less of his contact is coming in those like, I'm just trying to put a weak ball into play sort of situations. That's a choice too, I should say. We talk probably every other week here about Keston Hira, but his like God, and I feel sorry for the guy, but like at the end of the day, like he made a choice to swing hard a lot of the time at some point in the upper minors, and then we fell in love with him as a look at this batting average in like high A, also here's some dingers once he's changed his approach later on, but didn't recognize
taking
that.
The best of both worlds, not realizing that one was sacrificed for the other, and then you get to the big leagues and you can't even do the one thing you were doing well anymore. So I will say there is you alluded to it when you talked about called strikes. There is a way that this could lie to you, right? A chase, if you look only at chase rate, and that would be somebody who's timid in their approach as they've been called up. They're not going to be chasing balls outside the zone, but their zone contact may be really low too because they're not swinging. So looking at even just like a swing percentage, right, to make sure that you're not being tricked. That stat on its own is super useful, but again, in connection to these things. And we try and talk about that as well. How can good information still fool you? So I just wanted to make that point as well.
Yeah, there are some things that I like try to do, and like it's not as easy to just grab them off of someone's page, which I think is kind of like the difference between like what I can do whenever I'm pulling my own numbers and what I want to do when I'm just like on my phone, or like, you know, some variation on that. I'm Googling someone in the middle of a podcast. I'm, you know, whatever that version is. I like to point to those numbers and then say, like, look, if someone's not swinging, you know, and the nice thing is you can see like an MLB average for like a swing rate. So if someone's like not near MLB average for swing rate for whatever season it is, I know those bounce around. I know they're typically around 50 though. If someone's like way low overall, you can see their zone swing rates. If you're like not up into the 60s there, that's a problem. Yeah. And you're going to have a lot of called strikes. And I will at that point be willing to disbelieve some parts of how good someone's like even zone contact numbers might be, because then you're only swinging against the meatballs. Like, you're not even chasing the edge strike pitches.
Right.
And at that point, we're no longer comparing apples to apples, and your numbers are less meaningful.
And you're more susceptible to being figured out quicker, I think, too. Especially with pitchers who have the kind of control that they do at the major league level. They're just going to nibble those corners, and they're going to, get you into pitcher's counts. All right, what are another set? Let's talk a little bit about, I think this is a really cool way of talking about this, so I'm not going to steal your thunder here, but a lot of times when we're looking at people from the minors, we don't have nearly as much data, and the big things that people will talk about are things like hit tool, power tool, speed tool, right? And it's like on a rating out of 80. So, you know, anything 50 or above is, you know, that's like, hey, let's take a look at this guy. But it has a lot more to do with the eye test. And we've talked to people who are, you know, do this kind of a thing and look at minors and prospects and things. And this next set of data is, I gather, looking at trying to maybe quantify that sort of eye test thing from the minors. So talk about this next set of data that might be helpful.
You draw an interesting distinction there. The things we just talked about aren't a bad way of kind of measuring some pieces of hit tool. We've previously talked to people like Trevor Huth, who I always want to make sure I say out loud because he's the person I probably bugged most in different forums about these things. But when we're talking about hit tool, there are a lot of choices that go into how well you can hit the ball. Knowing when to swing, making choices overall about when you plan to swing before you come into the bat, how hard you want to swing, blah, 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 all that stuff, right? That's complicated. You know what isn't complicated is how hard you can hit the ball at your very hard, like best, and how fast you can run at your very fastest. And that's what I think makes a lot of the power speed guys so like fun is it's easy to figure out who they are. And we get some even better data. Now, we already have some pretty good data in the minors, and like scouts will have a lot of this stuff, but like we get way, way better data once some people jump to the majors about the numbers here. You'd say is max exit velocity and kind of like the similar sort of stuff for sprint speed. So like however you want to measure like someone's like max sprint speed or like best, you know, like home plate to first times or first to second times, because you only have to do that really well like once.
And we can max it. Right. If you're capable of it, let me rephrase that. If you're not capable of it, you're never going to do it. And if you are capable of it, you might not do it all the time, but you know that the skill set at least is there and it's showing up at the major league level, which is important. Now, the downside of this is obviously the max EV for a call-up could come at the second to last game of the season, and that doesn't really help you in the short term. But in terms of the conversation of looking for next year and understanding, there's a lot of value there. And maybe you're lucky. Maybe in the second at bat, the max EV is a number that really is helpful for the short term. But just again to draw the distinction between somebody who's looking to maybe make an ad for a fantasy team versus somebody who's really kind of looking for their own eye test and backing that up with numbers and data at the major league level in preparation for next year.
Yeah, I think that the way I want to kind of like pitch that is really narrow, but like kind of in line with what you're saying there about like the for the future sort of stuff. If you can put up an elite sprint speed or an elite exit velocity, barring things like injury that would like rob you of those tools, those are what you're capable of at the very least. And, you know, someone may not set a really, really scintillating max EV of like 115 or whatever. But that doesn't mean that they're necessarily not capable of that. But if someone does, then like that's what they're capable of. People like Pete Alonso, I remember hearing Eno talk about a max EV. I think really what he said is he heard the ball and he's like, oh, and then because he was at the I think it was at the, it's probably like first pitch to Arizona before his big year or something like that. It's like this story I'm telling poorly here, but you know, it's like you hear the ball absolutely crushed, the data can back up that observation and you're like, oh yeah, that dude can just murder some baseballs. And his right. like 80 grade power that someone had written down that you could kind of like disbelieve if you're going to like FanGraphs or wherever to grab those, suddenly you can no longer disbelieve that. It's been proven this dude murders baseballs better than almost anyone else.
Yeah, and we saw that at the home run derby this year for sure. All right, there's a third component here that I think is really, really important, and it really has nothing to do with stats, but it has to do with opportunity. You want to talk about the kind of this third set of information that's not like ratios and stuff, but it's very, very important.
Yeah, I think it's important to pay attention to like how players are making their debut and kind of a few of those sorts of things. Like if you're trying to figure out like what a team feels about a player, there are a few tells that might be important. Right now there are going to be some teams that just are really, really thin, and some people are going to get called up soon, and it's possible that they will end up playing pretty much every day. And that does not necessarily mean that that player is going to be a starter next year, because obviously injuries are putting in those cases.
Right.
One of the ways it might get expressed, though, and that we can kind of like gauge how highly a team feels about a guy, is going to be the like lineup spot that they're getting when they're playing.
Yeah.
So, you know, today, for example, here today, this is going to be like almost a week old by the time this comes out. It's very funny to me.
Sorry,
very
everybody.
Funny to me, actually. no, don't be. You know, like Houston rested like seemingly half of their team. Because injuries and just kind of like that's the reality, is we're getting to a point where, you know, people are tired. They've been playing a lot of baseball recently.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to remember who it was exactly, but like they had quite the not interesting lineup today. And one of their lower end the order guys, I have this in front of me, I swear, hit like a home run way over the crawfish boxes. And it was beautiful. And I was really happy. Taylor Jones. Now, obviously, we're not even into September, so he's not like a September call-up, but that's kind of like the model sort of thing. He had a nice home run, but he was not batting high in the order, and it's not like they're like pitching him as a guy who's going to be like a next big thing or anything. And that should be an obvious one, right? But you're going to see teams like Pittsburgh, like Baltimore, like Baltimore again, let me repeat that. Hopefully they'll have won a game by the time this podcast comes out. You know, they're going to be calling people up because they're going to need someone to play shortstop, or they're going to need someone to play some of those outfield spots. And if they're batting seventh, that is not necessarily a mark of like trust. However, and this is where we get to finally talk about some dudes. If you're batting higher in the order when you're being called up in this slim case, because they're just so much like more likely to be players of consequence, that is a good marker of the trust that a player might be getting. Now, the last little caveat, and oh my god, I have so many of these that I could just pull out of the bag, is that you know how competitive some of these playoff races for these good teams might determine some things. If you're like hypothetical Gavin Lux being called up for the first time again, or a hypothetical Kyle Tucker being called up for the first time again, and September-ish, as you know, some of them made most of their like initial impressions kind of late in the season, where you get placed into that order will tell us a lot about how a team feels about you. We definitely saw that reflected when the Mariners were calling up Kelnick earlier this year. Get called up and batted third immediately. No, it's not that they know something we don't, it's just kind of like an affirmation of how they feel. So I do want to make sure we're paying attention to those sorts of signs about like how often they're batting, maybe on their weak side platoon, and you know where they're batting in the order and how much trust they're getting, because you know it's possible that some of these teams know more than we do, because they might have the Statcast-ish data from their time in the minors that we don't have.
Right. And I mean, they definitely do. The teams definitely do have more information than we have access to on the public side. I mean, that's probably true all the way through, right? I mean, at the major league level, but there's so much available on the public side at the big league level that we can kind of comb through that. The minor leagues is just very, very different, but the teams definitely have a mountain of that information. And I think that's a really good point. Somebody gets called up and they're playing every single day. That seems really great. But if they're batting eighth or ninth, it's probably just a situational thing and not a, this guy's got tools that are going to surprise you thing. And the teams know that. And so it's like kind of a filler. But somebody who is coming in and maybe doesn't have a huge hit tool, but is batting cleanup suddenly, you know, I don't know how those discrepancies would come to be, but it's certainly possible that they're there and that it's based on data we don't have. And that would be really eye-opening.
I would say a more likely version of that maybe is that someone gets scooted up the order after, you know, like a hot 2 or 3 days. There might be them having some belief that it's part of that. You know, they might be scooting someone up in the order because their data, because their information tells us that, yes, we can trust this hot, short stretch right. of play, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, anybody who is on a major league roster, whether they're a call-up or not, they're good at playing the game of baseball. And so they can have hot moment. You know, sometimes these guys get called up. There's not really a book on them for other teams, or they're hitting seventh and the pitchers are attacking them and they're making good contact. If you see a team then move them up to fifth, then that's kind of like, well, they have information we don't, and what they're seeing is supporting that, so that the eye test is matching data they already have that we don't have access to. If they're staying put in the seven hole, then the team is probably thinking, wow, that was really awesome and really lucky, but probably is just that. So it sometimes the behavior around this is really important too.
Yeah. Now, I think a lot of this is like, you know, all contingent on this like hypothetical pathway for the future that we've like, just like imagined up for like some just like Joe examples. And a lot of this makes more
Joe example. Nice guy.
Yeah. Best man at my sister's wedding, actually. Anyways, I think it makes a whole lot more sense if we like, actually talk about just how weird about a month's worth of games can be for some dudes. Because we've seen how this has played out, and it's worth also talking about, just kind of the last piece, how a tiny cup of coffee can just totally derail our entire opinion of someone as a player. We've talked about this so many times about how like someone might have more value in fantasy drafts if they'd never debuted at all, rather than if they had and they kind of were just mediocre. And a guy I want to zoom in on there is someone whose name I've already said today, and that is Kyle Tucker. Kyle Tucker debuted in 2018. For the first time. It feels like he hasn't been around that long, but yeah, you know, he made his major league debut in 2018. Actually, like, not even September. It was like, I believe it was like June of that year. He got like optioned back down and kind of like bounced back around a little bit. But he had a very not that great 2018. I know this because, and I think I've said this a few times before, I have a whole lot of friends who are from Houston and really, really, really love to watch the Astros and have since they were really, really, really bad. Being able to kind of go through their relative neuroses about that and with him has always been kind of something that I get asked to do. Yeah. And so before I was even writing about baseball, I think I was like bugging my friends about Kyle Tucker and whether or not he's actually going to be good or not. His first year, not great. There are a couple different things about it that I think are really interesting. So, in 2018, he was 21, just as a note. He struck up 18% of the time, which is really impressive. And he put up a really good hard hit rate, especially when you consider the fact that he was striking out less than 28% of the time, a 45% hard hit rate. That is exceptionally good. His ex-WOBA was 324. His actual WOBA was 207. The dude could not have been unluckier. There are a bunch of different things to tell us statistically that like he wasn't just unlucky on the basis of like things like fielding. He was also unlucky on the basis of things like line drive rate and sweet spot rate, which players don't have a whole lot of control over.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to his 2018 numbers, his sweet spot rate, pretty obvious one here, 21.6%. League average is about 32. You cannot be over or under that by a significant amount without being like really lucky or really good. You would assume that a 21-year-old in a small sample is probably really unlucky, and he was crushing the ball anyway, just mostly into the ground, and you would pretty obviously assume that something was a little bit up there. Let's see. What was his line drive rate that year? Find that so we can... Yeah, 19.6%. Again, you can only put that number up if you're really unlucky. And then 2019, he comes up September 2nd, and his strikeout rate is not great, 27.8%. This is the only time it's been significantly over 20% in his career in any sort of sample. But again, he crushes the ball, and he puts up a 349 WOBA on the back of a 344 ex-WOBA. We knew the dude was great. He put up like 30 home run seasons in the minors before reaching like the age people would be still in college, right?
Yeah,
the
right.
The dude was the fifth pick for a reason. And I think a lot of people's like understanding of him as a prospect kind of shifted around. And you might remember that in 2019, the Astros called up another outfield prospect, Yordan Alvarez.
Who?
You may have heard of him. If you were a very online person, you may have recalled refreshing on Reddit or wherever you were thinking about who they were going to call up every single time someone got injured. And ended up that Tucker, had to wait much longer than a lot of people expected. He was like drafted and stashed.
Yeah.
But, you know, people's opinions of him really, really took a hit that year. And here, look at them now. But both Tucker and Yordan are like top 50 picks and redraft at this point, like pretty comfortably. Yeah. They're good at baseball and they always kind of were. But you would have to have taken some really bad kind of like outlooks. That's a weird sentence for his 2018 sample, which is like pretty normal in terms of length compared to like a September column or like a 1 month of a rookie year. And just another month of a rookie year the next year.
Well, I mean, a month of any player is really anything can happen. Somebody who's really good at baseball could have an unlucky month or a cold month or a bad month, or, you know, they're fighting a little bit of an injury and they're not telling anybody, or at least they're not releasing it to the public. So, I mean, when we're we've said this a lot about small sample size, you have to be really, really careful about overreacting to small sample sizes. And outlier performances, it's easy to get caught up in it. Hey, this guy burned me, so I'm gun shy. Well, I mean, that's maybe a mistake, because you're going to miss out on that production. Anybody who had drafted and stashed Kyle Tucker and was like, man, that name, I see it. And that was so frustrating that season. I'm just not drafting him. Well, now you're missing out. Right. So, I think that's really important. And then there's the flip side of somebody like, and we had talked about this off air before we got started, but like Randy Arozarena, right, who caught lightning in a bottle and hasn't been bad this year, but certainly hasn't lived up to what he was doing at the end of last year and through the playoffs. And I think he probably got drafted maybe a little bit higher, and people are maybe frustrated by what he's become. Which is more in line with what he was kind of expected to be. So I think it's really, really easy to overreact to these small sample sizes, and we get really excited. We've been doing a really long baseball season. Fantasy baseball is a long haul. It's a marathon. It's not. Fantasy football is fun. It's different. It's faster. It's over sooner. Fantasy baseball is a slog, that's for sure. And the idea of new blood is exciting, but you have to be careful not to overreact to it.
I think that last bit is a really good kind of way to collapse down exactly what it is that that kind of like drives a lot of us. The new cool thing, rather than the guy that you have rostered for 120 games already, or maybe like three or four seasons in the past, those are a whole different experience in terms of what makes this energizing. And I get why there are a lot of people who kind of like dip their toes into this industry and then just find that like the week in, week out, I need to have another like really incredible thing to say when the game hasn't changed that much. Can be really defeating, actually. So, you know, if you're in our shoes anywhere or you're like interested in this and you're wondering why the person that you like have been enjoying reading their stuff and you're like, you know, they're not writing as much anymore or they're like taking a step back, it's because, you know, there's just so much time to worry about whether or not your take is good. And I will say, it's kind of nice September call-ups just getting a whole bunch of new dudes to kind of be like,
yeah, sure.
No, I swear this guy's good. That is a really fun thing.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, analysts have they're victim of their own quality, right? People have gotten really good at doing this, and so it's hard to be separate. It's hard to be different. It's a saturated industry. There's a lot of people who are doing this kind of work. And, you know, that shouldn't be a reason why anybody doesn't try and become the next person to come in. I have found it to be a pretty welcoming community overall. And so that shouldn't stop anybody. But at the same time, people have gotten really, really good at figuring out who's good. And you know, I think a lot of the analytics when they first were coming out, they were helping people see these market inefficiencies for fantasy in the same way that major league teams are seeing market inefficiencies for putting together actual on-field baseball. And there was a lot of space and room for that to for people to put out content that was helping people think about this in new ways. But they've done such a good job at that and continue to do such a good job at that, that it's harder to differentiate between, you know, this guy and that guy, or this guy's take and that guy's take, especially player A and player B over a season where the differences are very nuanced. And so I think your point is well taken. And there have been a lot of writers that I've seen, even very publicly saying like, look, I'm kind of at a burnout level, and, you know, coming on the heels of the COVID thing and the lockdown and the stress and all that stuff, it makes perfect sense that people are needing to take a break. And I think your point is well made. But I also think it's because the work is so good. So it's a double-edged sword. Lot of quality work out there as well.
Yeah, you know, it's really interesting to notice that it's a lot of the people who I feel like tend to do some of the most in-depth work. And that stuff can really, really leave you lingering in that, like, is my work any good state for the longest? The excitement of being a writer is very much kind of like a sine wave, you know, it's like, it's like I have a new idea and then I've started to do the research, and then you get stuck in a ditch for a while, and feeling bad about like the fact that it hasn't all come together yet. And you've got like one little hurdle, and as you get closer to publication, it swells back up and you feel great when it's published. And then you get another idea and you keep going.
Yeah. I think it's like any art. I mean, I am a music fan, and I've done some of my own music stuff and writing songs. It's very similar. You get excited about an idea. You got a chord progression. You've got a melody. You got a harmony you think you're going to want to put in there. You got a nice hook. You play it over and over and over again on your couch to try and construct this thing. And now you've heard it so many times, you never want to hear it again. I'm sure it's similar with painters and, you know, people who are really all about their craft and their art are constantly trying to be better and are often their own worst critics. And there's not really anything anybody's going to say on Twitter or anywhere else that's going to be more harsh than what they're telling themselves. So keep that in mind, too, while you're posting things on the social medias. There's a couple of other players here. Let's talk a little bit more specifically. You have them here in the show notes. And I'll let you kind of carve out the context for it. But let's talk about a couple more players as kind of like examples of the point we're trying to make. And then we'll do a short pass fail. And our 30th episode will be in the books.
Wow.
Yeah.
Pretty good. Yeah. So I think that if we're kind of taking a look at the people who we would expect to potentially come up and have an opportunity to at least show who they are, maybe make a difference. We're looking at people who have to be like one on a 40-man roster already, or like really likely to be added, I think is kind of like the more likely case. You know, you really go on a case-by-case basis, but it's much easier if they're already on the 40-man roster and like in triple A.
Yeah, of course.
Right. From there, I'd also want to make sure that like they're, you know, like not fully blocked in some way or another. There are actually quite a few guys that I feel like I have some thoughts about that, like, I would really like to see them come up, and then, like, I don't know how it works.
Yeah, because there's already somebody, if they play shortstop and in the Padres organization, well, barring another separated shoulder, that's going
to
be tough.
Right now, this is a great time to be a Padres shortstop prospect. Well,
I mean,
there were not going to be many great times to be a Padres shortstop prospect after, like, you know, this next month, whenever Tatis's shoulder gets surgically put back in place. But this is a great time if you are healthy. I think Abrams might. I think he's not healthy. Yeah.
My point being, if you've got somebody who's really locked into a spot, and I mean, are they? This is an aside, and I'm going to follow this down a rabbit hole. Are they talking about Tatis having surgery in the near term?
Oh yeah, you know, that's been the plan all along. Is that he has when the season's over?
Yeah,
he
when
has
the season's
a surgery.
Over.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
So I mean,
but he's in the outfield right now. That's the thing.
Well, that's true. Yeah. That's true. But
that's what I was referencing.
Okay. Either way, the point being, let's take out the nitty gritty of that particular situation. I guess I brought up a terrible example. My fault. But if you're talking about somebody who is stuck behind a big time player, the club really doesn't have an incentive to call that person up. And that's another piece of this, is that it's not, if somebody doesn't get called up, it's not necessarily that they're not going to be great. It could be that the club just doesn't have a real reason to need to do that. And that definitely plays a factor as well. Anyway, back on track to the players that you were going to reference.
Yeah. So, like I was saying, need to be on the 40 man, need to have at least some viable pathway to some playing time, I would say. And we also probably need to, like, have some belief that they are good enough to care about for the future and make an impact this year. Like, obviously, right?
Yeah.
So, like, a really quick way to I would sort this before you get too far is just, like, I'm going to run through people who are, like, on, like, the MLB Pipeline 100, and maybe mm-hmm. there's going to be some other guys who are just outside of it or that have made the name for themselves. And these are guys who are going to have, like, an ETA of this year or next year that aren't already fully up. That's
right.
It. Who else are we going to care about?
Yeah.
And when we go look at those people, you realize how slim the list actually is. So, like, CJ Abrams, like I said, he's a 2022, like, ETA for the Padres at shortstop. Mm-hmm. He's sixth on their list. I think he's had some injury troubles this year, and I would actually very much doubt that he's going to play. They have depth. The Crone zone has moved over the shortstop side. So I'm not all that worried about him. Likewise, like, Riley Green just moved up to AAA. Spencer Torkelson just moved up to AAA. Bobby Witt, actually, there's a guy that you might want to look at if you're looking at the top 10 guys. And then Adley Rutschman just moved up to AAA. I would assume, like, a lot of these guys, like, you know, they're all recently moved up. I would be surprised if any of them saw time, because, like, the let's be honest about it pathway is that they come up after the extra year of eligibility passes next year. Like,
that's
probably what's gonna happen. But there are some other people who I think make a lot of sense. Not necessarily within the top 10 or so, but it, you know, like, Joey Bart would make a lot of sense, actually, if it weren't for the fact that the National League still is evil and forces pitchers to hit baseballs. Vidal Brujan, though, is like the most obvious, and he's, like, almost certainly in my mind probably going to find, like, be there. We go, almost certainly, probably. What a great combination of qualifiers there. I would be really shocked if he wasn't back on the Rays roster. For one, there's just not going to be any, like, real obvious chances for him to develop, but there aren't games going on. And at some point, there's just going to run out of minor league games. Further, like, the things that he can do well are going to be valuable, even if it's a very limited role. You know, if he's a pinch runner on that team, that is better than nothing. And he could do that well. But, you know, like, he's going to get time. They're going to want to rotate people around. He's, like, the exact obvious template for someone who's going to get called up. So he's, like, the easiest name, if in terms of people we would look at. There are a couple other people who I think kind of fit that same role, like Taylor Walls, I think. He's on his way back up for them, I'm sure. But, you know, like, you might find a couple other guys, like... See, I had a list here, and I just feel really dumb. You know, like, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, well, pitching side, like, that's a whole other discussion. But, you know, like, people like Christian Pache, like him, who can do those sort of, like, be a defensive outfielder, if we're again looking at people who aren't currently on rosters. Again, injuries are a whole other thing, but like, if you have a pathway to a very small scale role, that is a more likely than not like reason why you might make it up. Now, it doesn't mean you're gonna be fantasy valuable, but it does mean you get more major league plate appearances, and that's more interesting. God, as I'm flipping through here, I guess, like, what's stopping Nolan Jones from coming up for Cleveland other than the fact that they don't want to like spend money on him? A lot of these guys are like, ready. Like, what's stopping Josh Lowe for the Rays? I thought he was going to come up in like July. So I guess that he's another guy that like utility outfielder slash center fielder. I don't know, maybe like another like injury for them in center field, and he could be up as like their fourth slash fifth outfielder. But I'm like, God, I forget that some of these guys like that I was been like waiting on the entire time. Like, where is Drew Waters? Why has he not come up yet? I felt like he was supposed to be up a while ago. You can kind of just run through those sorts of guys ad infinitum. So, yeah, I think that like we'll probably be surprised,
yeah,
in some ways by whoever it ends up being.
The big league clubs aren't calling guys up to make your fantasy life easier. So there's a lot of things and factors that go into those decisions. And, I think the surprises are good, especially from the, again, from the top, the two different perspectives. I think from the point of view of like, hey, let's see what this kid can do at the end of this year so that we have a better idea for next year, or, get a few at bats so that we have a better idea about draft capital for next year's fantasy team. It's the, I need a guy right now, that's really hard. And hopefully we gave you at least a little bit of a process in terms of what to evaluate, how to look at maybe some of those minor league numbers, how they translate to the first couple of weeks of the call up, and hopefully you grab the right one. I think that's really kind of what it boils down to, though, right? Like, we can try and add a scientific process to all of this, but in the end, you can do your best and you can still make a good decision that just doesn't work out, because it's just a very difficult place to be to try and get the right guy at the right time. And there's also a chance that of all the guys that come up, none of them really are more helpful than the guy you already have. So good luck, question mark.
I think the thing I'm excited for is just arguing about whether or not we can buy someone's inevitable like 8 homer September. And that is always a fun time.
The conversations about what kind of a player is this based on whatever happens here from now to the end of the season certainly is the more intriguing and interesting and engaging part of it. Again, from that point of view, from the point of view of how are September call-ups going to help me get the title? I think it's a lot more of kind of a roll of the dice, but hopefully there's some things that can point you the right direction. At least, you know, it's like we teach kids on multiple choice tests, right? Like, see if you can eliminate two wrong answers so that you're at least picking between two right ones. Hopefully, at the very least, we've given you that equivalent for these call-ups. All right, I'd like to transition here into our pass-fail segment and do it in just a couple of minutes and wrap up the episode. We'll push our off the books to another episode. But we've talked a lot about September call-ups here, and I want your take on whether or not this should even happen. So should we have expanded rosters? Should it be what it used to be? Should it be what it is? What's your take on this?
So I think that we should absolutely have some sort of expanded rosters. I get why they don't have it during the regular season in terms of like having like an infinite number of players that are available to you, because it would be a really interesting financial advantage for some clubs that, you know, would be more like the kind that we don't like rather than like the competitive floor. Like, I get that. I do like also like the trade-off of like having 26 players rather than 25. I get that. I like that. The thing that I would say that I would ideally like is I would like a version of expanded rosters that don't impact decisions for people's playing time being manipulated in some sort of way. That's the one thing that I worry about, because then it's like, okay, someone's pretty good, and why call him up in September if the like maximizing the window of how much you have him tells you you should call him up after Super 2?
Right.
But then it's like, okay, so we called him up in September instead, and that feels like ahead of his schedule instead of behind, so that means we're just going to hold him down more next spring and pretend he wasn't ready. Like, that's the really cynical view that I want to make sure doesn't happen. And I think the answer is you got to fix, like, playing time manipulation or service time manipulation, and then also just have like a 40-man roster rule that kind of comes second to that in terms of the things you fix.
Now, let me ask an ignorant question. Couldn't they just put in that anybody called up in September, it's just separate from normal season playing time? It just would that just solve it?
You know, I don't know if that would solve it, right?
Well, yeah, it wouldn't solve the playing time manipulation problem that exists separately. But I guess my question is, if they said this is just it's like a showcase, call them up. Here's the limits of how many you can have. But while they're here, that doesn't accrue time. It wouldn't make them like push
those
it until
deserve the time though. That's the thing. Like,
yeah, I guess that's true. But the team is just recapturing it on the flip side. Right. Which is the real problem you're talking about.
Right. Right. So what you want then is you want a version of things where they get the time, but there's no incentive for a team not to give it to them. If they're like vaguely in the area, I think the answer might be that if I could point to one thing that would fix it, you just need like the arbitration process, the decision for Chris Bryant's ruling, where they basically the Cubs argument was like, no, we didn't manipulate his time, that would be illegal. The books basically say, no, you should not manipulate these things, and then teams just make up fake excuses why they aren't, and then the people who adjudicate things go along with them and believe them. If the actual human element that allows us to interpret these things, you know, if Chris Bryant's hearing about whether or not he had his service time illegally manipulated said, yes, he did, I think that would actually fix about 49% of the problem.
That's probably true. I guess what I'm getting at is I hate the idea that having somebody come up in September would mean we have to wait longer for them to be up in the beginning of the following season, which is what teams are naturally going to do. We come back to this all the time, the business of baseball interfering with the on-field product and what's best for things. The entire process of service time probably needs to be revamped is the solution, right? The entire system is flawed.
You know, a version of these things that I think like I could come up with, and this is a thing that I've toyed with a lot in my head, is like, how do we maybe create like a two-track system for people who are called up from the minors? You know, like you've got the superstar track, essentially, where you're guaranteed a higher salary right out of the gates. The teams are guaranteed more years of control as a result, versus like maybe you have like the depth track for players where like, you know, their starting salary when they come into the league is, you know, something around what it currently is, maybe a little higher. That'd be good. Mm-hmm. But like they get to free agency faster. So there's like a trade-off for like some people have like 6 or 7 years of team control, but their starting salary is like $2 or $3 million guaranteed versus like the other guys. And that would, I think, change a lot of the incentives. And then you put like a certain number of like the teams have to decide by, let's call it 30 days of them being on a roster, which means that you could do September call-ups without them having to decide.
Yeah,
maybe that's something like that could fix it.
That's definitely an interesting solution. I don't know if there are loopholes in there. I'm sure some of the major league clubs would find them, but I it's at least a creative outside the box way of doing things. And you know, maybe a player has some say in that. Maybe the way that it's written in the CBA is that it's a mutual agreement decision, and that gives the players a little bit of leverage there as well. As opposed to just club control, that would certainly be a step in the right direction for players as well.
Yeah. I think that the incentives for some players would be a little bit muddled. I don't know. Maybe you put a cap on the number of like superstar contracts you can give out every year or something like that.
Almost like the franchise tag in the NFL.
Yeah. Well, I think about the way that like I think about this is very much influenced by the way that the first round draft picks in the NBA draft are guaranteed higher starting salaries and more guaranteed years, whereas second round draft picks are only guaranteed like less. But that means they get the free agency. And if you hit on a second round guy in the NBA draft, you get a couple years of big benefits. But that guy actually gets his payday. He gets a payday. Right. I think that there's some room for people who are not sure things before they hit the draft to like not end up being kind of like screwed by it and ended up getting a payday, because a lot of those same guys didn't get those big initial signing bonuses that get held over the heads of players for people who are making those bad faith arguments for not paying them well. So,
well, leave it to us to turn a question about should rosters expand into a much bigger issue, but it's all kind of tied together, as is almost anything in baseball. You flip one domino and they're all going down. I like the idea of rosters expanding. I almost feel like
it's so much fun.
It really is. And the way that they used to do it, it really gave you a look at a lot of different players, which was kind of neat from a baseball fan, not from a fantasy point of view, but from a baseball fan. You get to see a lot of these guys at AAA, especially when I was a kid and I was going to a lot of Paw Sox games. I'd get to see the guys that I was watching all year in Red Sox uniforms. That was super exciting as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
But I kind of feel like if they're at the point where they've gone to 26 and then you expand to 28, just like make it 28 for the year. That's actually better for everybody, right? Because now you've got more rostered players collecting salaries. I mean, I know the owners don't want that, but
how much money we're quibbling over there too. Like the additional cost there is probably on the order of about $1 million.
Yeah. Maybe. Which was a lot to Austin Powers in 1960, whatever. But I don't know. I feel like there was something romantic a little bit about you could have 40 guys in a dugout, and obviously no team was doing that. But you got to see a lot of people, and they take at-bats. And if you're watching games all the time, you're seeing a lot of the people who you're going to start seeing called up in the future years. Like there, I don't know. Maybe it's an old fogey thing in me. I don't know. But I think it was fun and it was exciting. Now that they've shrunk it, I'd like that it's still there and we're going to see some people called up who maybe ordinarily wouldn't get their chance until next year. But I'd almost rather just see the rosters be 28. Like just expand the rosters. I mean, I know that's it's not going
to
fly.
Go to 30 at that point, right? Make it an even number.
well, 30 from 25 is a big difference from just a couple years ago.
I think, but the thing that it would help out with, 30 this year or 30 last year would have been so good, because then like 6-man rotations can be a thing. Or, you know, as we're kind of gradually moving towards this thing where pitchers pitch fewer innings, you can have more of those like once through the order guys who are kind of imperfect but really cool. And I think the thing that we get really annoyed about with like relievers changing around mid-inning is kind of one thing, but like the scheduled, yeah, this guy's gone through once and we know the next guy's coming up, and we're not just like screwing around with like one lefty. Like I don't have any problem with that. So like that sort of base, like almost all of those arguments about baseball changing are like pretty boring and dumb. And I'm all for anything else that can get another guy who's really good that gets us something closer to like what the Giants are doing to be good this year being more normal. Because like, look at how many dudes are playing really well in those somewhat more limited roles driven by better data and good instruction. Like a larger rosters could pave the way for some of that as well.
It seems really silly. Like rosters expand by 2. I don't know. Yeah. Again, historical context comes into play there. Maybe expanding the rosters by 2, if it was 0, would feel like a lot, and that's super awesome. But going from like a lot to 2, I don't know. It feels like why bother? Like just make it 28, and especially, I don't know, if COVID has taught us anything, it's that weird things happen and people are getting injured much more frequently. You'd be able to have a guy nurse an injury for a few days and fill in without having to do an IL stint. I don't know, which would be bad for fantasy, I guess, because you'd have hurt guys not playing and not being able to IL stash them. But I don't know. I don't know where I stand on this in its current iteration. I like the idea of rosters expanding, but I kind of feel like at this point, maybe it should just be an all year thing. And then more guys are getting paid. There's more players, you know, on major league teams. I don't know. Maybe that's problematic too.
Yeah, I think it's probably also worth just talking about in both like everyone's incentives about like preventing injuries should be aligned. Teams don't like it when they're hurt. Players don't like it when they're hurt. Players' agents don't like it when they're hurt. Fans don't like it when they're hurt. nobody should be happy about anything that leads to more injuries. The more that we can give teams preventative steps. Like, look right now, like, the Dodgers are trying to catch the Giants for their division, and they have, like, nobody healthy on the pitching side, and somebody's probably going to get strained and we're probably going to get see more injuries as a result.
Yeah.
The White Sox are not in a position where they're chasing anybody and they're able to rest people, and that's going to give them a competitive advantage later on. I don't know. I mean, like, you can see all these different tinkering things that are like smart things where like the DNP rest sort of stuff that's in other sports gets to come in. And I think that like the more that we can just keep players from having to hurt themselves, like, we guarantee those two extra roster spots for some of these teams are just going to be, they sign a pitcher off the street who can throw them four innings so they can just get to September, you know, like 28th.
Sure.
And yeah.
But I don't know. I guess we'll have to see. I don't think they'll probably do it. So I'm very interested to see how this plays out this year, being the first year of it, and in subsequent years, what kind of an impact it really has and whether it actually takes a lot of the air out of the excitement that used to be there, or whether it's just as good because, like I said early on, those guys that are the impact guys are still probably going to be there and making a difference. So any last words that you have here? Not like forever. That would be terrible. But before we end the episode,
I guess if I have anything else, it's, that, all to the people who are asking me if, Tyler Tucker was good in 2018. Yeah, he's good.
Yeah, he's good.
We solved that one.
Problem solved. All right. Well, that's going to bring us to the end of our 30th episode. 30 already, Alex. That's amazing. If you could go ahead and just let the people know where they could find us.
Well, they can find you on Twitter at The Corked Matt. I'm on Twitter at Chase_Rate. And most importantly, you can find our podcast on Twitter at Dugout Study Hall, where you can send us some questions. Please be sure to subscribe to the Pitcherless podcast feed if you haven't done that already. Leave us a good review if you can be so kind. And if you're not already, please consider becoming a PL Plus member so that you can harass us on the PL Discord. And that's it for me.
All right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, and we'll catch you next time.